Okay, so I have the privilege to have the last say. No, just kidding. Actually, I'm, as Anna said, going to talk more about silence. But first, I'm going to present myself a bit. So I'm Aura, and I'm a PhD student at the University of Paris 8 in gender studies and at the University of Turku here in Finland in comparative literature. And my research is about feminine and feminist style and alternative knowledge in plurilingual and cross-cultural women authors' work. And all of the writers I have gathered in my corpus, they share the same kind of background in the sense that they all come from a colonized country. And they have spent their childhood and youth in this colonized country. So, like, questions of colonialism, post-colonialism, decolonialism, and also feminism is very central to their work. And also, they are all more or less related to the second wave of feminism, because the texts I have chosen come from the 70s or from the 80s. And I'm not a film scholar, but I'm going to show you a scene of Marguerite Duras's film Nathalie Granger from 1972, and it's because it addresses many of the same topics that I'm investigating, and also because I love this film, and I wanted to show one particular scene of it to you and hopefully discuss it with you in a sort of like semi-scholarly but not too academic context. And then I thought that the summer school of Tutkijaliitto would be perfect for that. And myself, I come from a bilingual Finnish-Swedish small town in the countryside of Finland, and from a non-academic family. And I'm kind of a very privileged person in many ways, also in the sense that I've been able to pursue my studies at the highest level of education, even though my parents haven't done that or even studied at high school. And so the topic of my presentation is decolonizing silence in Marguerite Duras's film Nathalie Granger. And the topic of silence is very personal to me and also to my family, because my parents, both of them, were born a few years after the Second World War. And so, like, their parents and grandparents experienced and suffered a lot of trauma during the wartime. But maybe in particular because we're in Finland and it's like a sort of common habit of the Finnish culture not to talk that much about difficult things, so I guess that I'm in a way following a pattern here, because they say that often when there's like collective trauma, it's the first generation that suffers it, then the second generation shoves it down and doesn't talk about it, and then it's the third generation that sort of starts to investigate and criticize and research or write about it. And that would be sort of my case then. But even though I'm not analyzing silence in the same context. Okay, this is I suppose this is enough for the presentation. For the intro. The multiple meanings and uses of silence in Marguerite Duras's work have mostly been analyzed in relation to pain, melancholy, depression, and the unspeakable. In short, in relation to negativity. And in my view, there are three major influences behind this line of interpretation. First, Julia Kristeva's essay, The Malady of Grief, in her book Black Sun, Depression and Melancholia. Second, Jacques Lacan's influential reading of Duras's novel The Ravishing of Lullenstein, entitled Homage to Duras. And third, French author and philosopher Maurice Blanchot's major work, The Space of Literature, that investigates the unspeakable death and loneliness. And in my view, this line of interpretation, focusing on the negative and to a large extent linked to French psychoanalytic theory, has ravished or even colonized a major part of the research of Duras's work. And in this presentation and in my research in general, I'm trying to, in a way, I'm choosing another direction because I'm more interested in the constructive and, so to say, positive meanings of silence in her work, because I think that they have been more or less neglected in earlier research. And in order to analyze and discuss the use of silence in her work, particularly as a means of humor and power, I've chosen to show you one particular scene of this film. And hopefully we have some time left. Probably we have enough time in the end to discuss it together. And to help us do the analysis, I'm going to present you two theories, or rather concepts. First of all, feminist philosopher Luz Irigaray's idea of mimesis, or strategic essentialism, and then feminist theorist Chandra Tolpaid Mohanty's ideas about decolonial and transnational feminism. So the scene I have chosen is a scene I call the scene of the traveling salesman. It presents a young Gérard Depardieu playing a salesman who sells washing machines from door to door, and then he enters the house of these two powerful, intimidating women, played by Jeanne Moreau and Lucia Bosé. And this scene is precisely in the halfway of the film, and to me it really constitutes the heart of the film, so to say. And there are English subtitles, but the scene is relatively long. It's about 15 minutes, so take a good position and enjoy. But before we watch it, I would like to, just to contextualize a bit, say a few words about the film and the director. So the film was shot in Duras's own house in Nofle-le-Château, a small town outside of Paris. And the film starts with piano music, played by the young 8-year-old Nathalie Granger. Next, we hear the female voice of her teacher telling us that the little girl has been acting violently at school, inventing stories, lying about her family, and the other day she hit another student. And so it seems that Duras is subtly hinting that it's the education system that is violent and creates violence inside of it or in its structures. Next, we hear a male voice coming from the radio as a voiceover, telling us that two teenage boys have shot with a machine gun two girls, and that they are now hiding somewhere in the woods near the house of these two women. And throughout the film, this male voiceover from the radio returns, telling us the latest news of the two killers, which kind of creates a haunting atmosphere of gendered violence. And several times along the film, we also have scenes from the school, from the teacher's office, where Nathalie's mother, Isabelle Granger, played by Lucia Bosé here, and her friend Jeanne Moreau, or played by Jeanne Moreau, discuss Nathalie's violence together with the school teacher. So we have like several juxtapositions. First, the violence of the young girl versus the violence of the teenage boys. Then we have a female voice and a male voice. And we also have a juxtaposition of the outside world and the inside world. And the inside of the house is presented sort of like a women's space, an intimate space of friendship and feminine solidarity, whereas the outer world, the public world, is depicted as a violent place, especially violent towards girls and women, as a contrast to the safe space of the inside of the house. And also the lens of the camera is, it often shows the two women like inside the house performing traditional sort of, so to say, feminine house tasks, like cleaning, ironing, burning the branches fallen from the trees in the garden. And in this film, nothing spectacular ever happens, but still there is this very intense atmosphere that is, to a large extent, created by silence. And the only music that we ever hear is the piano music played by the young Natalie. And the camera is mostly set on the inside of the house, describing the everyday life of these women, either inside the house or in the garden. And several techniques and framings, such as panning and filming the women's hands performing house tasks, are very similar to the techniques that were used 5 years later in British feminist film theorist Laura Mulvey's and director Peter Wolan's experimental feature film Riddles of the Sphinx, where they explored, among other things, the so-called female or feminine gaze. And before we watch the scene, also a few words about Duras. So she spent her childhood and youth from 1914 to 1932 in Vietnam, that was at the time colonized by France. And in her early years, she witnessed the racist and sexist everyday life of the colonial and patriarchal system imposed by imperialist France. And in her book, Fictionalizing Trauma, the Finnish literary scholar Sirkka Knuuttila has analyzed Duras's fictionalization of Asian colonialism in Duras's so-called India cycle that consists of novels and films that were made in the 1960s and 70s. And in addition to this India cycle, and her other cycle that is called the Vietnam cycle, where she especially focuses on the issues of colonialism, she addresses topics such as power, domination, oppression, suppression, silence, and unlearning in the whole of her work. One important contextual detail I would like to mention before the film. She was part of the Communist Party. She joined the Communist Party after World War II, and before leaving it 8 years later, disappointed in the party. But however, still in the 1980s, she considered herself a communist who didn't recognize herself as part of the communist movement. And then the other social historical fact I would like to highlight regarding women's institutional silencing in France is the fact that when Duras started her career as a writer and published her first novel in 1943, women of France didn't yet have the right to vote. So basically no basic political agency in the society where they lived in. And in the French Revolution, women were reduced to passive citizens who didn't have the right to vote, and they had to wait for this basic civil right for more than 150 years before gaining it finally in 1944. And in my view, the institutional silencing of women and the female subject is very central to her work. But now let's see the. We're all quite tired. Normally, I laugh a lot when I look at it. Now I was just like, oh, I want to go to sleep. So, and also, I don't know if it speaks to me only because I'm a white woman and the women in the film are white. The color white was raised in the In the scene once, but sort of only like a, I don't know. Maybe you can tell me later on if it had any importance or not. I would like to comment a bit on another analysis that has been made on this film, and then move on to my own, and then we can discuss the scene afterwards. So in the beginning of 1980s, the film was analyzed by American film scholar and director Ian Kaplan in her article Female Resistance in Marguerite Duras's Nathalie Granger. And I'm gonna just present her reading shortly, sort of to show in a way how, I don't know, how science, what kind of paradigms come and then they go and in a way she's very precise in her analysis and everything, but to me it represents something really essential of the way like French feminism has been interpreted in the 80s, and if it's really appropriate and current nowadays. So she starts her analysis of two quite interesting interviews of Duras that she gave in the 1970s, where she talks about the hippie, and she says that the hippies excel at doing nothing. Getting to that point is fantastic. Do you know how to do anything at all? I don't. That is what we lack most. And later, in another interview, she claimed that the hippie is a creature who has absolutely no ties with anything. The hippie is not only outside every sort of security, every sort of welfare, but outside everything. But after quoting these interviews, Kaplan moves on to state that that this film develops the kind of feminist politics that was articulated in French by French theorists later in the 1970s. However, instead of anchoring her own thought on a firm feminist ground, in my view, she sticks to a quite traditional Lacanian Chris Devon interpretive frame. But she sort of summarizes the Lacanian frame so well, so that I'm just gonna cite a passage of her article to be accurate. Influenced by Lacan, French theorists focused on language and on the fact that language, as a main tool of social progress and social organization, has an inherent male bias. It follows that if language is by definition male, women who speak it are alienated from themselves. Using Lacan's distinction between the world of the imaginary, seen as pre-linguistic, and the world of the symbolic, the language-based order, they argued that women were forced to find their place within an essentially alien linguistic system, which, linear and grammatical, orders the symbolic, the superego, and the law. A real contradiction faces women. As long as they remain silent, they will be outside the historical process. End of quote. Kaplan claims that the two women here, they choose silence as a strategy for resisting domination, and that for Duras, silence, paradoxically, becomes a means of entering culture because it marks a gap, a fissure, through which change can possibly take place. However, Kaplan finds several problems with this kind of politics, most of all, assuming women's essential difference from men. She also says that it is dangerous to accept women's exclusion from the symbolic realm, since this realm involves large and important areas of life. But my question is this exactly actually what Duras is doing here? I don't think so. I think that the problem in Kaplan's reading is rather that she herself sticks too much to the Lacanian frame and thus doesn't really analyze all the nuances that exceed the theory. I think that, for example, in the scene of the traveling salesman, the women do not refuse some monolithic, totalizing male language per se, but rather by repeating the word no several times, they refuse the empty marketing jargon of the salesman. And when the woman... Okay. No. Okay, I must move on. Maybe I'll just skip her analysis. Well, basically, she doesn't really analyze the critique of capitalism here, nor does she analyze the class or other differences between the two women. Or actually, there are several of them. There's, for example, a character of a Portuguese cleaning woman who has herself signed her expulsion because she doesn't know how to read French. And so in my view, Duras is not dealing here with some monolithic, ahistorical notion of language or woman, but she is attentive to differences between individual women and to their class differences and etc. Maybe I should... Because I would have wanted to present a concept of Lucie Rigaray and then talk about Mohanty's ideas. I'll start with Rigaray and then if we have... Well, let's see.
Real quick.
Okay. the Finnish... philosopher Virpi Lehtinen says in her book Luce Irigaray's Phenomenology of the Feminine Being, she distinguishes four different kinds of essentialisms, and one of them is metaphysical essentialism and the other one is strategic essentialism, and metaphysical essentialism holds that a woman's nature consists of sharing certain biological, psychological, or metaphysical characteristics. And these characteristics are shared by all women, and as such, they form the criteria for being a woman. And this first main position in the debate of Irigaray's conception of woman attributes to her the idea that essences are non-temporal and unchanging, ontological, etc. So this is like the idea that was that prevailed in the 80s and also in Scandinavia, like this is the way people interpreted Irigaray. But she has also elaborated the same concept as Spivak, and that's the concept of strategic essentialism. And for example, to Irigaray, to play with mimesis is for a woman to try to recover the place of her exploitation by discourse without allowing herself to be simply reduced to it. It means to resubmit herself to ideas, in particular to ideas about herself that are elaborated in or by masculine logic, in order to make them visible by an effect of playful repetition, like the fact that was supposed to remain invisible. And I think that's what's happening here. The women are recovering the place of their exploitation by discourse, or rather exclusion of discourse, without allowing themselves to be simply reduced to that non-existing place. So they are not simply reduced to silence as passive, muted non-subjects, but rather by using their traditional feminine or female role not associated with power, they are able to unexpectedly and surprisingly turn the power relations temporarily upside down. And So they sort of like they so in my view they sort of like I would like to use the word metaphorical here. Metaphorically smash the unequal and unjust patriarchal capitalism that, as we well know, has produced a system where the wealth of the world is overwhelmingly pocketed by mainly white male elite. And also there's a lot of irony in this sense. Irony is part of strategic essentialism. So by the ironic and playful, yet also haunting and canny repetition of the word no, the women make visible their traditional invisible role in discourse. So mimesis or strategic essentialism becomes like a canny mimicry projecting the women's silence as positive. Here I have the passage about Spivak. I don't know if we have time for that.
Well, you don't have any time.
Sorry, I didn't have the time to go to the decolonial stuff, well, basically my point to make was that I think that it would be good to sort of combine ideas that have been used by both Irigaray and Spivak, but maybe in a way to move on from this universalist and ahistorical interpretative models given by Lacan, for example, to more like accurate analyzing and theorizing in order to approach like universal concerns more thoroughly, because this is really what Mohanty is talking about to me in Feminism Without Borders. But maybe you can just you can tell me whatever you want. Sorry. No.